Hey, man, somebody mentioned last week, I think it was, that they felt like they'd gone through a seminary class because there's so much information that is coming out, and tonight I think is going to be no different. So I hope that's okay. Just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. That's what I like doing as we're going through this, is go to the scriptures, and this is what they say, and then we'll let the Bible speak as far as the doctrine and the truth that we have right in here. So tonight, as you can see, we're talking about the Antichrist and the false prophet. And these are the ones that are going to be in charge of a world system, a world government in the last days. And so we're going to look at the scriptures that have to do with that. And of course, these are the topics that we keep adding to as we go through this series here. And I think the main thing that I just wanted to bring our attention to again is the approach to interpretation, and that being the literal approach as opposed to the figurative approach. And that's going to give us oftentimes the certain understanding that we have on events that are yet to come. And so just as a brief reminder in the timeline of what it looks like, is I believe we're coming to the next great event being the rapture of the church, the pre-tribulation rapture where Jesus returns and removes his church off of the earth before a seven-year period of tribulation, also known as the 70th week of Daniel. And then at the end of that time period, the second coming of Jesus, the setting up of his kingdom upon the earth for 1,000 years, and then at the end of that time period, the destruction of the heavens and the earth, the great white throne judgment, and then the creation of the new heavens and the new earth, and what we would refer to as eternity, or really heaven as we're looking for it, just being with Jesus, and all of the yuck is behind us, and we're just with him and whatever, you know, he has for us for all of eternity. So that's the basic timeline that we're looking at as we're going through this. And tonight we're going to talk as I'm kind of trying to take us in a chronological way through prophecy as we're going. We talked about the 10-nation confederacy last week, and tonight I thought we would talk about the Antichrist, the one who's going to be ruling during that time period. So a number of titles, I guess you might say, of the Antichrist in Scripture. In the book of Daniel, he's referred to as the little horn, a king who is fierce and sinister, the prince who is to come, the one who makes desolate, the king who does as he pleases. In the book of Zechariah, chapter 11, he is the worthless shepherd. In 2 Thessalonians, he is the man of sin, the son of perdition, the lawless one. And then in the book of Revelation, chapter 6, he's the rider on the white horse. Chapter 13, he is the beast out of the sea. And then in 1 John, we read it, his title as the Antichrist. And Antichrist is the name most commonly associated with this final world ruler. It refers both to an individual and to the system he represents. In 1 John chapter 2, verse 18, it says, "Little children, it is the last hour, and as you have heard that the Antichrist is coming, even now many Antichrists have come," by which we know that it is the last hour. So he refers to an individual, as we know the Antichrist, singular, is coming, yet future, even now many Antichrists, even now presently many Antichrists, plural, have come, past tense. And so it's talking about an individual who's coming, but also an attitude or a system that is present and has been present. And it is what? It is Antichrist, opposed to Christ. The word Antichrist is used 5 times in the New Testament, all of them in John's letters, where we get the term. The prefix anti can mean against Christ or opposed to Christ. And that would fit the Antichrist, wouldn't it? He is someone who is against Jesus. He is opposed to Jesus. It can also mean instead of Christ or in place of Christ. And that would fit as well, because he is the great imposter. He is the one that wants everyone to look to him and lead everyone, just as everybody that loves Jesus follows him. And so This is an apt title, and that's the one that's most commonly used for this world ruler who is yet to come. A.W. Pink says, he will seem to be and will set himself up as the true Christ. He will be the devil's counterfeit. Now let's talk about the rise of the Antichrist. And I bet I have 30 scriptures we're going to be looking at. I thought rather than turning to all 30 of them, we'll as a group just turn in the book of Revelation and I'll put the other ones up on the screen, okay? So if you want to go ahead and turn to the book of Revelation, the last book in the Bible, and we'll get there in just a moment. But we'll talk right now about the rise of the Antichrist. He will appear, I believe, after the rapture of the church. And again, the reason that I believe that is I believe in a pre-trib rapture. And it tells us in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, beginning from verse 6, and now you know what is restraining, that he may be revealed in his own time. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Many antichrists, a system like that, already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. And then the lawless one will be revealed, the antichrist. Notice whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. When Jesus returns, it is then that he is going to destroy the Antichrist. It is then that he will be cast into the lake of fire. And so there is this restrainer that is keeping the Antichrist from being revealed upon the scene or appearing. And I believe that 2 Thessalonians 2 is talking about the restraining influence of the Holy Spirit that is within the church. Us as believers, God is working in our lives and he is using us to restrain evil in our world today. And can you imagine that once the church is taken out, what it's going to be like here on earth? Chuck Swindoll says this in his commentary on 2 Thessalonians. He says, this man will emerge after the rapture, probably to calm the chaotic waters troubled by the unexplained departure of so many Christians. He will be primed and ready to speak. He will stand before not only a nation, but a world, and will win their approval. Like Hitler, he will emerge on a scene of such political and economic chaos that the people will see him as a man with vision, with pragmatic answers and power to unite the world. Can you imagine the kind of disarray the world is going to be in when all the Christians are taken off? I think about the airplane that went down, Flight 370, I think it was. You remember it? It went down just not too long ago, and nobody knew what happened to it and how the world is wondering, what happened to those people? That's one airplane. Think about the millions of Christians that are all of a sudden, they're gone from the earth. Think of the chaos that would ensue with that alone, but also the wonder. Where are they? What happened to them? And it seems like it's at times like that, when there's a hole, when there's a void, that people are looking for someone to pull it all together, someone to come in and to lead and say, yeah, it's going to be okay. And it's a perfect setting for the Antichrist to come on the scene. And so the rise of the Antichrist, I believe, will take place after the rapture, that the church will be taken out. And then at some point after that, he will appear and he will be the man of the hour, so to speak. It also is going to begin the day of the Lord, not the rapture of the church, but the rise of the Antichrist. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3, it says, let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition. So he will come on the scene after the rapture, and when he comes, he is going to the first thing that he will do is he will usher in this peace treaty with the nation of Israel. It will be very subtle. He won't come on necessarily as a man trying to bludgeon others into authority, But he will come on in a subtle way, bringing, first of all, peace to the Middle East. Can you imagine that? After so many decades of trying, there's going to be one that arises that is actually able to confirm a peace treaty. In Daniel 9:27, it says, "Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week." And this is the final 70th week of years of the Daniel prophecy. And so he will confirm that covenant or that treaty of peace with many. This is going to be Israel, because that's the focus of the 70 weeks of Daniel. And I believe the many would be Israel and Israel's neighbors. That's the speculation that I would take on this. So as he comes to power, rather than coming as this dictator trying to bring everybody under his thumb, I personally think it's going to be a little more subtle. He's going to be the guy who has the answers. He's going to be the one that can pull the world together. And so the peace treaty in the Middle East, and also in Daniel 7, verse 8, he's referred to as the little horn. I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one. It's interesting in Daniel 8, when it's talking about Alexander the Great, he's referred to as the notable horn. And the Antichrist here is referred to not as the notable horn, great with a lot of power, but he's the little horn that comes up. And again, maybe that is a reference to the fact that he comes on subtly. He comes on with a peace treaty as a charismatic leader. Again, a lot of this is speculation, but just trying to pull it together as we look at the rise of the Antichrist. Now, as we talk about the acts of the Antichrist, some of the things that he does, he's going to be a very arrogant person. The Bible says in a number of places that he's going to speak very boastfully, but it's actually specifically very blasphemously, if that's a word, speaking blasphemies against God. Daniel 7, verse 8, again, "And there in this horn, a mouth speaking pompous words." Daniel 11, 36, "He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods." And so this is going to be one of the character traits of the Antichrist, his arrogance, his blasphemy, particularly against God. Okay, we're in the book of Revelation now. We're in Revelation chapter 13, if you haven't turned to that chapter. And we're going to follow this theme right now, his arrogance, his blasphemy. In Revelation 13, 5, and we did read through all of Revelation 13 last week, so I feel like we're fairly familiar with it. The first half of it speaking of the beast out of the sea, the Antichrist, and we will read the latter half of it talking about the beast out of the earth as we get to the false prophet. Revelation 13, verse 5, it says, "And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months, 3.5 years. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven." So he's given, as it says here, a mouth speaking great things, literally speaking big things. So he's got a big mouth, but you can see that the big mouth is that of arrogance and speaking against God. Back in verse 2, where it's describing the beast, it says that he was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. So he will be speaking very boastful things in his arrogance, specifically against God. He's going to be killed. Not talking about the lake of fire, but he's going to be killed. Look at verse 3 of chapter 13. "And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed." Both the words mortally and deadly literally is referring to death. So there's going to be what appears to be a successful assassination attempt against the Antichrist, that he will actually die. Now in Zechariah chapter 11, it says this concerning the worthless shepherd, "For indeed I will raise up a shepherd in the land who will not care for those who are cut off, nor seek the young, nor heal those that are broken, nor feed those that still stand, but he will eat the flesh of the fat and tear their hooves to pieces. Woe to the worthless shepherd who leaves the flock, a sword shall be against his arm and against his right eye. His arm shall completely wither, and his right eye shall be totally blinded. Now, what does that refer to? Commentators feel that this is referring to this assassination attempt against the Antichrist, that he is the worthless shepherd that's been raised up, and he's going to be hit with the sword. It mentions specifically in the arm and in the eye. Keep that in mind as we go through this. It says again in verse 3, he saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and it refers to his deadly wound. Now turn over to Revelation 17. Revelation 17, verse 8. It says, the beast that you saw was and is not and will ascend out of the bottomless pit. The bottomless pit in Greek, the abyssa, we talked about that on Sunday. It was the place at the fifth trumpet judgment where the angel came down, had the key, opened the bottomless pit, and remember the horde of demonic locusts coming out of that. It's saying here that the beast, again in verse 8, that you saw was, he was alive and is not, he suffered that assassination attempt, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit, coming back to life and then ultimately and go to perdition, the lake of fire. That's interesting to look at that like that, isn't it? Turn over to Revelation chapter 11. Revelation chapter 11, and this is in regards to the two witnesses and the fact that the beast, the Antichrist, is going to put them to death. Revelation 11, verse 7, it says, when they, the two witnesses, finish their testimony, the beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit will make war against them, overcome them, and kill them. And so this Antichrist, it seems that it's saying he will be killed, but then he will come back to life, ascending out of the bottomless pit, a demonic resurrection, if you will. Revelation 13, 3, and I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. He'll be brought back to life. Look at verse 12 of Revelation 13. This is the false prophet, but it'll reference the Antichrist. He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come. I'm sorry. Verse 12. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. Again, it's talking about his mortality, that he has suffered a deadly wound. He's been put to death, and yet he was healed. Verse 14, and he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast, notice, who was wounded by the sword and lived. It's interesting, the sword, remember back in Zechariah, that a sword would be against him and against his eye. And the result of that is it's going to cause all of the world to be amazed. Again, verse 3, I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. Just think about that for a moment. If it was just, I got cut on my arm, and oh, he poked my eye out with the sword, the whole world wouldn't marvel after him, would it? It would have to be something greater than that. It seems like that's what it's saying, and also that's what's implied, is that he has died, and yet he has come back to life. And so all of the world not only marvels after him, but also follows him. And this is what I'm wondering, is that when he comes back, he is, as it says, he is ascending out of the bottomless pit. It seems like he is possessed at this point, like he is now, not that he wasn't already, but he is truly now, he is Satan's man as he comes out. Look at chapter 13 at the end of verse 2. when it says that he was like a leopard, a bear, a mouth of like a lion, the dragon, it says, gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. The dragon, chapter 12, verse 9. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan. So here the beast, it says of him in verse 2, the dragon, the devil, gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. Look at verse 4 of chapter 13. So they worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast. And so he has the power of Satan. He has the authority of Satan. He has the throne of Satan. And so this is a characteristics of the Antichrist. Who is he? What is he like? And what will happen to him? So it's going to cause the entire world to be amazed at him. We talked about the 10-nation confederacy last week. When he rises to power, he's referred to as the little horn. But notice in Daniel chapter 7, verse 8, what takes place. It says, I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns, notice, were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking pompous words. So he's rising to power, but he's also vicious in his heart. He's taking down three of these other horns. And that's interpreted for us in Daniel 7 as kings. In Daniel 7:24, it says the 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall rise after them. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue three kings. And so he is going to end up being the ruler of this 10-king confederacy. And he will be one that comes up. And in so doing, he will pull three down with it. It seems like the others will go ahead and go, yes, you can. We're giving you our authority and the right to rule. And maybe it's speculation, but maybe three of them are like, nah, you're not going to do this. And he does it anyway, and he takes them out. Revelation 17 tells us that. Revelation 17, verses 12 and 13. Tell us the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. And so he will rule over this 10-nation confederacy, those kings giving them his authority, but three are taken out. We can only speculate again that these three didn't want to go along with it, so he takes them out as he rises to power. In his rise to power, he starts off, it seems, peacefully. He starts off, it seems, subtly, but he becomes a great persecutor, especially of the Jewish people. In Daniel 7:21, it says, I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them. In other words, overpowering the people of God. In Daniel 7:25, it says, he shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time, prevailing over the saints for a 3.5-year period. Notice one of the details in 7:25. It says he shall intend to change times and law. In the New Living Translation, that interprets that, the changing of the times, as changing their sacred festivals. It reminds me of Daniel 9:27, where it speaks about his end of the sacrificial system. Again, he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. He will put an end to their worship of their God, the Jewish people. And he will proclaim himself to be God. So he will come in again, I think subtly, but he will come in and he will be very vicious and persecute the saints of God. Back in Revelation chapter 13, in verse 7, Revelation 13, 7, it says, it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. So he's going to persecute the people of God. And we've been talking about the saints of God here being persecuted, being overcome for a 3.5 year period. And again, I'll just remind you, when it's talking about the saints, it's talking about those that are separated unto God. And that could refer to the Jewish people. It could refer to, in the New Testament, it could refer to you and me, because Paul, when he's writing to the churches, he refers to the believers as saints, those who are set apart to God. In the book of Revelation, when you get to the time of the tribulation and it talks about the saints, it could refer to people who have become believers during the time of tribulation. It simply is referring to those who are set apart from this world, but set apart exclusively for God and his purpose. And I believe when we're reading in these passages, we're talking specifically here, primarily, I should say, about the Jewish people, because this is the focus, especially in the book of Daniel. And don't forget, in the book of Revelation, this tribulation, the 70th week of Daniel, that period is primarily focused on Daniel's people, the children of Israel and the city of Jerusalem. Personally, I don't think the saints of the church age are going to be around, but I do believe there will be Gentile believers that will suffer persecution during the tribulation, people who have become believers after the rapture of the church. And so, again, that's my opinion, and I hope I'm right, and that's the way that is in my mind, okay? So, notice, though, with this, there's going to be the persecution. He's risen over this 10-nation confederacy, but at the end of verse 7 of Revelation 13, it says, authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. That sounds like a world dictator to me. It sounds like he's starting off getting into this revived Roman Empire, and then it's going to grow to seek to control the entire world. That's what seems to be saying. Now, it'll be an attempt to do that. I think he'll probably be very successful in doing that. But in the end, we do hear at the end of Daniel 11 that news from the east and from the north troubles him. And so there are groups that are coming out to battle against him. So he's seeking to, and largely successful at ruling the world, but not everybody is going to fall in line with that. And ultimately, the Battle of Armageddon is going to see the nations of the world gathered in the Valley of Megiddo in Israel. And, you know, that will be the battle of all battles at that time. So he is going to come in. He is going to seek to change the times and laws, the sacred festivals of Israel. He's going to put an end to sacrifice and offering, again, very clearly put in the middle of the week, in the middle of this final 7-year period, 3.5 years into it with 3.5 years to go, he's going to end. So we're at the midpoint of the tribulation where he's going to put an end to their sacrificial system. And 2 Thessalonians 2 gives us, I think, some more details on this. He's going to claim to be God. In 2 Thessalonians 2, 4, it says of him that he opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshiped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Those are powerful words, isn't it? It's not just that he's claiming to be God. He's showing that he's God. How do you show that you're God? You know, how do you deceive people into thinking that you're God? It's got to be the supernatural, doesn't it? It's got to be the miraculous. And that's what we're told as well, that he is able to deceive with great signs and lying wonders. And so people are going to fall for the deception. That's the idea. But notice where this is taking place. It's in the temple. So tie that together with he's going to put an end to the Jewish people's sacrificial system. The place that the sacrificial system takes place is at the temple. When God said that they were to offer animal sacrifice, it wasn't just offering an animal anywhere. It was the location that was equally important. It was to take place at the temple. That's really the big problem for the Orthodox Jew today, is there is no place where they can go and offer their animal sacrifices. That's the reason that the Orthodox Jews would like to see a temple rebuilt. And I believe that's why a temple is going to be rebuilt. There's going to be a drive that causes that to come to pass. And the scriptures are showing us that there will be a temple that is rebuilt and functioning in the last days. Otherwise, we couldn't rightly interpret a verse like this to see him going into the temple of God and showing himself to be God, or to put an end to the sacrificial system. There has to be the temple in place to do that. And I know I said we were going to talk about the temple, but I couldn't squeeze it into tonight's study, but that is coming. We will do that. And so he will claim to be God. This is tied together with what Jesus said would be the abomination of desolation, the abominable thing that desecrates the temple, this sacrilege that causes the true worshipers to flee because it has become ceremonially unclean. In Matthew 24:15, Jesus said, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand, then flee. Run for your lives out of Jerusalem, because it's going to be a time of great tribulation, unprecedented persecution." And so the abomination, this thing that's so horrible that's going to desecrate the temple, we're seeing a great picture of it right here. It's this man whose blasphemy against God has led him to the temple to show himself to be God himself. And so this is the blasphemy that takes place, the abomination of desolation. But did you catch this here? And this is important in Matthew 24:15. Jesus said, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel. So he's pointing us back to the book of Daniel. And the phrase, the abomination of desolation, is used in Daniel 12, Daniel 11, and a form of what we saw in Daniel 9, where he's talking about making the covenant for that final week. And then on the wing of abominations will be one who makes desolate. So it's mentioned three times in there. The interesting thing in Daniel chapter 11 is it's couched within the context of Antiochus Epiphanes, when he, in the second century BC, so the time is important here. In the second century BC, Antiochus Epiphanes came and desecrated the Jewish temple. It was the time of the Maccabees, where they rose up and they were able to fight them off and take back Jerusalem and the temple and to cleanse the temple. And they celebrate Hanukkah to this day to acknowledge that. And so Antiochus, it's said that he put an altar to the god Zeus at the temple, and he forced the Jewish people to offer swine's flesh upon the altar, which is an unclean animal. So you can see it's the thing that desecrated the temple, and it's referred to as the abomination of desolation. Now, when that prophecy is given to Daniel in the 6th century BC, it was 400 years before it would actually come to pass under Antiochus, okay? So it was spoken of in the 6th century. It came to pass in the 2nd century BC, and yet Jesus is saying right here in the 1st century AD, when you see in the future, he's not looking backwards, he's looking forward. When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel. So how do you put this together? This is a great picture of typology here. It's a great picture of what is referred to as dual fulfillment of prophecy. What you have in Antiochus IV is he is a type of the Antichrist who's yet to come. Just as Antiochus desecrated the temple and persecuted the Jews, so the Antichrist in the future will desecrate the temple and persecute the Jews. Does that make sense? It's a great picture of that. And what's so neat in this passage is Jesus is pointing that out so clearly. Because from a historical point of view, in the 1st century, he knew what had taken place by Antiochus. He knew what had taken place in the cleansing of the temple because he was at the Feast of Dedication, the Feast of Lights we read about in the Gospels. And so he knew that happened, and yet he's referring to it as something that's going to take place in the future. Isn't that neat? And so it's a great picture. That's why we focus in Daniel 11 on what Antiochus did, because we're piecing together what will it look like in the future when this takes place. And so he's going to claim to be God. He's going to desecrate the temple. And as we read in Revelation 13, he will be worshipped. Again, Revelation 13, verse 4, it says, "So they worshipped the dragon," who is the devil, "who gave authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, 'Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with the beast. Look at verse 8. It says, all who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. Everybody on earth is going to worship. Well, let's read that a little closer. Verse 8, all who dwell on the earth. There's kind of a significance in the book of Revelation. It talks about earth dwellers, those who have made the earth their home, as opposed to those who have made heaven their home. Because there's going to be heavenly-minded people during the tribulation. There's going to be the 144,000. There's going to be people who get saved. But all of the earth dwellers, they're going to end up worshiping the beast. And again, the supernatural, I'm sure, is what has so much to do with this. Just like in the context in chapter 13, his apparent resurrection from the dead. Also, 2 Thessalonians 2:9 tells us the coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all power, signs, and lying wonders. Lying, deceptive miracles. They're going to follow after the beast and worship him because they've been deceived. And so he will be worshiped. It says at the end of verse 5 of chapter 13 that he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. That's 3.5 years. So we have that 3.5 year window here, in this case for the Antichrist, that he will have authority. And so these are the acts of the Antichrist. We've looked at the rise of the Antichrist, the character traits, the things he's going to do, and ultimately we'll see the end of the Antichrist here. Look at Revelation 17, 16. It speaks in Revelation 17 of the great harlot, Mystery Babylon the Great. This, as we looked at in the past, this religious system that will be in place in the last days. I think we see the seeds of this in the ecumenical movement, where faiths drop their essentials for the sake of unity. Let's just come together and all have a good time and be one happy family. And that, I think, will characterize the beginning of this time. And think about it. It makes perfect sense once the Christians are taken off the earth. You know, why not? It makes sense that the ecumenical movement will just flow, where religions of all kind will come together, because there won't be those standing for the essentials of what makes, well, especially Christianity, Christianity. What makes Christianity, Christianity is Jesus. And Jesus is the one who said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. You can't really merge Christianity with any other religion. People who do that really aren't following what the Bible has to say. It's people who are Christian, I don't want to judge, but in name, but aren't really going by what the Bible teaches. That would go, you know, we can harmonize with other faiths. It's okay. Not if you go by what the Bible teaches, because the Bible teaches really clearly that there is only one way. And the logic in that is this: sin is what keeps us out of heaven. So our sin needs to be forgiven. And Jesus is the only one who brings that forgiveness, that atonement, because he died in our place. It comes back to the justice of God, doesn't it? That we have sinned, the penalty is death, and that justice has to be served. And so Jesus died in our place. He's the substitute. So when I receive him as my Savior, then in justice, God can forgive me because Jesus has already paid my debt. That's what makes the logic of Jesus being the only way so clear. And so to try and merge Christianity with another religion, it's basically to say Jesus died for nothing. You know, if I can go to heaven by another faith and not by Christianity through the one who died for me, then Jesus really didn't need to die, did he? If righteousness could come through the law or any other means, then Christ died in vain. And so that's the exclusiveness of Christianity. But it's not what we as Christians come up with on our own. It's what we read in the Bible. It's what Jesus himself said. It's what clearly is marked out. So there's going to be this ecumenical movement in the last days, in the sense of all religions are going to come together without the essentials being important. In verse 16 of Revelation 17, it says, "And the 10 horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot, make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh and burn her with fire." It's the end of Mystery Babylon. And notice it's the 10 horns, the 10 kings that are doing it. Remember, this is that 10 nation confederacy of which the Antichrist is the little horn who has come up taking three down. So it's turning against this religious system and putting it down. And it makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Because the Antichrist is saying, no, you're not going to have your ecumenical worship, whoever you want to. You're going to worship me. And the focus is going to be on him. That's what's happening with the Jews. That's what's going to happen with this religious system. So he's going to attack this religious system and put it down. Also, as we read in Revelation chapter 11, verse 7, he's going to attack and kill God's witnesses. Revelation 11, 7, it says, when they, the two witnesses, finish their testimony, the beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit will make war against them, overcome them, and kill them. He'll put an end to these two that are proclaiming the testimony of God in the last days. But that's not the end of these two witnesses, is it? Because these two witnesses come back to life and they ascend up into heaven. And that's exciting, isn't it? Because God is greater than even death. But this is the Antichrist. This is the end of the Antichrist, what he's going to be doing. He's going to be snuffing out the religious system. He's going to be putting out the two witnesses. He's even going to be leading all nations to Armageddon. Let's look at Revelation 16. Revelation 16, verse 13. This is when the sixth bowl is poured out. It says in verse 13 of Revelation 16, and I saw three unclean spirits like frogs coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. Unclean spirits that are coming out of their mouth. I would interpret that kind of as this is what they're speaking. This is the deceptive, demonic thing that they're speaking. Verse 14, for they are spirits of demons performing signs which go out to the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. And that battle, verse 16, is Armageddon. And they gathered them together to the place called in Hebrew Armageddon. It's the valley of Megiddo there in central Israel. So he is going to lead all nations to Armageddon. We see that all nations in Zechariah 14 are gathered against Israel. And then finally, I mean, this is the topper right here in Revelation 19. Revelation 19 tells us of the second coming of Jesus Christ. In Revelation 19, verse 11, it says, now I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse. And he who sat on him was called Faithful and True. Look at verse 16. And he has on his robe and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. This is Jesus at his second coming. In verse 19, it says, and I saw the beast, the kings of the earth, and their armies gathered together to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. That's the ultimate in futility. There's just no way they're going to win, but that's what they're going to do. They're going to attack Jesus when he returns at his second coming. And notice his doom. It says in verse 20, then the beast was captured, and with him the false prophet who worked signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These two were cast alive into the lake of fire, burning with brimstone. This is the ultimate end here of the Antichrist. He's cast into the lake of fire. Parallel this with Daniel 7:11, where it says, I watched them because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. I watched till the beast was slain and its body destroyed and given to the burning flame. When Jesus returns, he's going to consume him with the breath of his mouth and the brightness of his coming, and he's going to cast he and the false prophet alive into the lake of fire. Now, 1,000 years later, chapter 20, the millennium takes place. Look at chapter 20, verse 10. 1,000 years later, it tells us the devil who deceived them, Revelation 20, 10, was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and the false prophet are. And they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. even though they've been in there 1,000 years, it's not going to be like they've been annihilated. They've been all consumed and there's nothing left. It says that they are there and that they, the devil, the beast, the false prophet, will be tormented day and night forever and ever. It's eternal damnation is what it is. And that's what the Bible teaches. That's what the Bible teaches the lake of fire is. I mean, that is a scary, scary thing. But remember again, the whole reason Jesus came and he died was to save us from judgment that we deserve. See, that's the gospel. That's the good news. And that's what's so important to understand in all of this. We serve a just God and we serve a loving God. So this is the Antichrist. This is the man who's going to arise to seek to, at any rate, rule the world. It's his rise. It's his activities. And as we see here, his end. Now, just briefly in the time that we have remaining, we'll look at the false prophet. The false prophet we've referred to a couple times here will be in Revelation 13, verses 1 through 10, speak of the first beast out of the sea, the Antichrist. And again, as we started the study, he has many titles, and we've looked at a number of different scriptures throughout the Bible concerning the Antichrist. Revelation 13, 11 through 18 speaks of the second beast that's coming out of the earth. And though he's not named it here in Revelation 13, he's commonly referred to as the false prophet. We actually looked at all three places where he's called the false prophet. In Revelation 16, at the Armageddon passage, Revelation 19, at the second coming passage where he is thrown into the lake of fire, and then Revelation 20, verse 10, where Satan is thrown into the lake of fire and the false prophet still there. So three passages that mention the false prophet. The scripture, though, that speaks of the false prophet is right here in Revelation 13. This is the primary spot of the information that we have concerning the false prophet. It says, or Mark Hitchcock in his book says this of the false prophet: he will serve as the lieutenant for the Antichrist, preparing the way and catapulting him to power and unparalleled success. Using stunning miracles, signs, and wonders, the false prophet will convince the world that the Antichrist is the leader they've been looking for, the man with a plan, the man who can solve the world's problems. So let's just read the passage here that we have before us in Revelation 13:11, where it says, "Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and spoke like a dragon." So it's the second beast of Revelation 13. The first beast, as we read through this last week, we noticed that this beast came up out of the sea, Revelation 13:1. "Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and 10 horns." And we talked about this last week, the final climax of human government upon the earth and the ruler over that final form of human government, the Antichrist. But here, this is the beast that says is coming up out of the earth. Now, what's the reason for the distinction there? What does it mean that the first beast came up out of the sea, out of the waters? In Revelation 17, it talks about the woman who rides the beast, and it talks about her being over many waters, and those waters are interpreted for us of many peoples, nations, tongues, and tribes. It's talking about the Gentile world coming up out of the sea. And so people will use this actually as one of the verses that would say the Antichrist is not going to be Jewish. He's going to be Gentile. I don't think it's the primary one. I think the primary one is Daniel 9:26, where it talks about him being from the same people group as the people who destroyed Jerusalem in 70 AD, which would be the Romans. But they would tie this with Revelation 17. And so the change then in verse 11, "I saw another beast coming up out of the earth." Some would say maybe this means the false prophet is Jewish because he's coming up out of the land, the earth, the land of Israel. And they will make that comment, but not everybody believes that. Some think the distinction isn't being the land of Israel, but a distinction between the earth, like the earth dwellers, versus heaven, the worldly minded versus the heavenly minded? I really don't know. I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. He's referred to again, as far as his nature, a beast. And it says he had two horns like a lamb. So he had the appearance of a lamb, and yet he spoke like a dragon. And of course, the dragon's already been identified for us as Satan himself. So it sounds like you've got this guy who has the appearance of a lamb, and yet he is Satan's man just as much as the Antichrist is. Doesn't it remind you of what Jesus said? Beware of false prophets. Interesting term, isn't it? False prophet, false prophets who come to you as what? Sheep, wolves in sheep's clothing. Yeah, a deception there. So that very well might be the case with this. Verse 12 says, and he exercises, and again, this is the second beast, the false prophet, and he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, again, whose deadly wound was healed. And so, as Mark Hitchcock puts it, this is the Antichrist's lieutenant. It's like it's the Antichrist's greatest cheerleader there that's given authority and pointing people to worship the beast. It's like, this is the guy you want to worship. He's the one that's pointing people there. He's like, kind of like John the Baptist was the forerunner of Jesus, and he came on the scene and he's pointing all the people to Jesus. This is like the satanic version of John the Baptist with the false prophet. It says in verse 13 that he performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. This is similar to the two witnesses where fire comes out of their mouths and consumes. It's very reminiscent of Elijah in the Old Testament where he would call fire down from heaven upon his enemies. In verse 14, it says, and he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast, again, who was wounded by the sword and lived. So make a statue to the Antichrist. Make something that you can worship. Verse 15, he was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Remember again, the lying wonders, the deceptive miracles that he's able to do. And so he gets the people to make a statue, an image of the beast, and he causes the image to be able to speak. And if nobody worships the image, then he will be able to go out and put them to death. It reminds me of Daniel's friends in Daniel 3. Nebuchadnezzar made the big golden image, and if you didn't fall down and worship the image, you were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. It's the same type of deal. Again, wouldn't this line up with the end of mystery Babylon the Great? Like, there's no room for any other worship. Can you see that? If you don't worship the Antichrist, then you're going to be put to death. And so he gives life to the image and causes those who do not worship the image to be killed. Verse 16, he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. He has got the economy wrapped up. There's no way that you can go out and buy anything or sell anything unless you're on his team, unless you have his mark on the right hand or on the forehead. Do you remember that movie back in the 70s, A Thief in the Night, where they have the barcode on the forehead? Do you remember that? Because that's where technology was at that time. You know, that was the mark of the beast, the barcode, and how technology has changed, and we've got these microchips that animals are chipped with right now to be able to track them, their whereabouts. And you know how accurate GPS is, even for the common individual with your cell phone. how that is. You can see where technology, we at least have to admit technology is here to be able to have control over the world. And after 9/11, I could see where people would actually want to buy into that, just so you knew where the bad guys were, you know? I mean, before that, it's like, hey, don't mess with my privacy, you know? I don't want Big Brother looking out after me. But after 9/11 hit, I could see that shifting for a lot of people, where if we knew where all the bad guys were, we would be a little bit safer. So not only is technology there, but you could see where the mindset could shift for a lot of people in that direction as well. But I think the mark of the beast has a lot more to do than just technology of tracking people and whether you can buy or sell. I think it has to do a lot with aligning yourself with the Antichrist, who he is, what he stands for. You're taking his mark. You're on his team. You're with him and you're opposed to Jesus Christ. You're part of the Antichrist system. And so he will cause those to take that. Can you imagine what it would be like to be a Christian during that time where you couldn't, how would you survive? You know, you would have people that would gather together to try and help one another out. And like Jesus said, unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. You couldn't make it for an extended period of time. But there will be those, as we'll see as our study continues, there will be those that make it, that will become Christians, that will be Jewish and come to know Christ and will be able to survive through the tribulation and make it out until Jesus returns. But it's going to be a very difficult time during that time period. It says in verse 18, here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. His number is 666. It's just very intriguing. What exactly does that mean? Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding count, calculate the number of the beast. Be able to, seems like mathematically, figure out what it is. Who is it referring to? And the number being 666. Now, we've talked about and we've seen the number 7 throughout the book of Revelation. It obviously has a figurative purpose in the book because it's used in a number of ways. A lot of people have looked at the number 7 as the number of completion, the number of, some say perfection. I don't think that's necessarily, I think we associate the number 7 with the divine, maybe the number 6, one short of the divine, falling short of the glory of God. Some see the number 6 as it's saying here, the number of a man. And maybe this is the ultimate man that is possessed by Satan trying to rule the world. Let him calculate the number of the beast. Some see it as the numeric value of the Antichrist's name adding up to 666. And as I mentioned last time, 1 in 10,000 names add up to 666. The way you would calculate that, let's say in Greek, alpha would equal 1, beta would equal 2. In doing this, in calculating the number, Caesar Nero's name came up to 666, a 13th century pope, Napoleon, check this out, Hitler, Mussolini, Stalin, Kissinger, their names come up. I still have not checked my name. Do not plan on doing that to see if it would come up to that. But, you know, whether that's what it's saying or not, you know, I don't know. Here's wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast. For it's the number of a man, and the number 666. It's interesting. Some commentators observe that there are 6 Roman numerals, and if you add them all up, you get 666. That, you got to admit, that is interesting. With that, in conclusion, I'll read from Mark Hitchcock. He's a great pastor and commentator on end times. In conclusion, he says, the two beasts of the end times will work in tandem to rule the final world empire. They will be entirely energized by Satan, forming an unholy trinity with him that will deceive the world. Human evil will be focused and embodied in these two men unlike any time in history. So this is one more piece of the prophetic puzzle of what is yet to come. What is it? It's the end of man's rule upon the earth is what it is. Man has been ruling the earth ever since the days of Adam and Eve, and there has been pain and injustice because of that. This, again, is the darkness of night before the dawning of the new day of Jesus coming and ruling upon the earth, turning it right side up. It's dark, and this is where our studies are taking us at this time. But we're going to come out of this dark night, and we will come into the new day shortly. But let's go ahead and pray, and then we'll open it up for comments and questions. Father, we thank you that we could spend this time tonight in your word on this topic, even though it's speaking of one who is opposed to Christ and wants to come in place of him as an imposter. We thank you for your word as it tells us of what lies ahead. And we thank you, Lord, that reading the end of the book, we recognize we're on the winning team. And we thank you so much for your love for us. We thank you so much for Jesus and his sacrifice for us. And we just pray that you would use our lives, Father, as a light, as a bright beacon on a hill to shine forth your truth in these dark days, we ask. In Jesus' name, amen.